up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. Police in Pakistan say militants today attacked a Shiite mosque in northwest Pakistan, killing at least 19 people. Aisha Tanzim has a report.
Friday is the busiest day at any mosque. More than 800 people were praying at the Shiite Imamiyah Masjid in Peshawar when sounds of explosions and gunfire erupted. Witnesses describe men in suicide vests armed with automatic weapons and hand grenades. They were wearing uniforms of the provincial paramilitary force. Two of them blew themselves up. Mosque security guards shot a third one dead before he could detonate his vest. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
Ukraine's military says 11 soldiers have been killed, 40 wounded in fighting in East Ukraine. Military officials say the fighting was particularly intense around the city of Debaltseve. A ceasefire agreement reached Thursday has not yet gone into effect. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko today told soldiers it will be a long time before peace is achieved.
Я хочу, щоб ні в кого не було жодних ілюзій.
Meanwhile, in Washington, the White House called the agreement a potentially significant step toward a peaceful end to the conflict. At least 7 people, including a local chief, were killed today when Boko Haram militants attacked a village in Chad. It was their first such incursion into Chadian territory. Witnesses say the militants crossed Lake Chad in 3 motorized canoes and attacked the village of Ngubua around 3 a.m. The militants set fire to parts of the village before being driven out by Chadian troops. Chad security officials say those killed in the fighting include the village chief, a police officer, and 3 civilians. 2 militants were reported killed. This is VOA News. Greece and its international creditors plan to meet today to discuss Greek demands for an easing of austerity measures imposed by its creditors. The Dutch finance minister said the meeting is designed to find common ground between Greece's goal to end what it sees as crippling austerity and Europe's reluctance to change the terms on the more than $300 billion in loans to Greece. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, austerity's chief advocate, praised the possible breakthrough in the new Greek government's contentious relationship with its lenders. Greece wants its creditors to give it a bridge loan for several months. Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has called on top U.S. officials to condemn the murder of 3 Muslim students near the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Speaking to reporters alongside his Mexican counterpart in Mexico City on Thursday, Mr. Erdogan criticized President Barack Obama, Vice President Joe Biden, and Secretary of State John Kerry for what he called their silence over the attack. Mr. Erdogan has been outspoken about what he calls rising Islamophobia in the West. U.S. President Barack Obama plans to sign an executive order aimed at encouraging companies and organizations to share more information about cybersecurity threats with the government and with each other. Mr. Obama will sign the order at a conference on cybersecurity and consumer protection at Stanford University in California. The White House says the executive order lays out a framework that will include protections for privacy and civil liberties, even as it removes barriers between the government and the private sector. The order will direct the U.S. Department of Homeland Security to work on voluntary standards for the entities sharing the information. State media say fighting between government troops and Kokang rebels near the Chinese border in Myanmar have left 47 soldiers dead and 73 wounded. The Global New Light of Myanmar newspaper reported today the government in Myanmar, also known as Burma, has notified China that the fighting during the past week has forced thousands of people to flee into China. It is not known how many rebels have been killed or wounded. 4 people were killed today in a train accident in southern India. At least 60 people were injured when 4 rail cars went off the rails near the town of Enakal. The cause of the derailment was not immediately clear. Taking a look at market activities at this hour on Wall Street, U.S. stock indexes up. European markets were up today, and Asia-Pacific stock markets were mixed at the close of trade. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The United Nations Refugee Agency reports suspected Boko Haram militants from Nigeria have attacked a village in Chad for the first time. The UNHCR says this deadly assault highlights increasing insecurity in the region as violence from the Nigerian jihadists spills over into neighboring countries.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva. Details coming up. Also in the news, the State of the Nation address by South African President Jacob Zuma was overshadowed by chaotic events before the speech. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Uganda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour. A Chad military spokesman reports that seven motorized canoes of about 30 Boko Haram militants attacked a fishing village on Lake Chad today, killing a small number of civilians, including the village chief. Colonel Azim Barmadowa Aguna confirmed the dawn raid in Ingubua. It is the first reported attack in Chad by Nigeria's Islamist rebels. The village, where as many as 7,000 Nigerians from the city of Baga have already sought refuge, is 20 kilometers from the Nigerian border. Aguna said the attackers burned most of the houses in the village before Chadian troops expelled them. Across the Nigerian border, residents of the town of Biu reported at least seven dead when an explosion rocked the busy market town in an apparent suicide bombing. Cameroon is sending more troops to reinforce security at the border village of Mabas after Boko Haram militants kidnapped another 11 people. Scores more have been taken or killed in the last 3 weeks. Moki Edwin Kinzeka speaks with soldiers being dispatched as well as residents and files from Yaoundé.
Soldiers in the Cameroon military sing as they leave for the village of Mabas on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. It is in the village that suspected Boko Haram insurgents have killed scores of people, slitting throats and shooting victims within the past 3 weeks. Yerima Buba, who is a resident of Mabas, told VOA in a telephone interview the attackers struck again Thursday night, stole cattle, burned a local church and a mosque, and kidnapped 11 people. He says seven of the kidnapped people were young girls and four were elderly women. That brings the number of people kidnapped so far in the border village in the past 3 weeks to at least 80, with residents saying a majority of them are girls and women. Elvis Madumbe, one of the soldiers deployed to the border village, says the armed forces are committed to eradicating Boko Haram.
They cannot defeat us because we are ready at any moment, any time, to defeat the Boko Haram. We are waiting for them right now to see what they will do. We are ready and prepared to face the Boko Haram.
Colonel Jacob Korje, commanding the troops, says in addition to the infantry, they have also mobilized the Air Force, especially at the Mandara Highlands on Cameroon's border with Nigeria, where Boko Haram insurgents hide after committing atrocities.
This line of defense is the infantry, and supported by the artillery. Mogode till Zelevet is the Mount Mandara Hills. Then after you have a plane from Zelevet till Lake Chad, it is more than 400 kilometers.
Early this week, suspected Boko Haram militants seized a vehicle transporting 20 people, killing seven of them and dumping their corpses on the border. They freed three elderly women but kidnapped the rest, including eight young girls between the ages of 11 and 14. These particular Boko Haram attackers are believed to be among the insurgents pushed out of Gamburungala, Nigeria, in a ground offensive by Chadian and Cameroonian troops at the beginning of February. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says a deadly assault on a Chadian village highlights increasing insecurity in the region as violence from Boko Haram militants spills over into neighboring countries. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says it received reports early Friday of an attack on the village of Ngubua on the shores of Lake Chad. Spokesman Adrian Edwards says thousands of refugees were in the town when the attack occurred. He says the details are sketchy, and the UNHCR is in the process of getting more information about the numbers of people affected.
The reports that we've received, the town was attacked by about 30 militants using boats. They attacked parts of the town itself. The chef de canton himself was killed. We were in contact with a refugee during the attack, but the phone line went dead. We're still trying to find out more about the situation there and the likely effects on other humanitarian work in the area.
Media reports say about two-thirds of the homes in the village have been burned, and the militants killed about 10 people before being chased away by the Chadian army. Cross-border attacks by Boko Haram militants into neighboring Niger and Cameroon have intensified in frequency and ferocity in recent weeks. The UNHCR says the situation has become extraordinarily dangerous for thousands of refugees and internally displaced people. It says the violence also is putting the lives of humanitarian workers at risk and making it extremely difficult to provide much-needed emergency assistance. An example of the disruption that is becoming commonplace can be seen in the fighting which broke out in and around Difa, a town in southeastern Niger. UNHCR spokesman Edwards says thousands of people fled in fear and panic. He notes prior to the attacks, Difa had a population of 50,000. Now the town is virtually empty.
Thousands of people have fled other towns and villages of the region. While most of the internally displaced are being hosted in local communities, there are serious shortages there of food and clean water. The situation is being exacerbated as shops remain closed. Humanitarian actors have had to significantly reduce their activities because of the general insecurity. At present, there are no humanitarian actors left in Bosso.
Similar scenarios are playing out in Cameroon as disconcerting reports emerge of killings, abductions, and brutal violence in the country's far north region near the border with Nigeria. Since Boko Haram began its quest to create an Islamic caliphate in Nigeria in 2009, the UNHCR reports more than 157,000 people have fled into Niger, Cameroon, and Chad. It says nearly 1 million others are internally displaced inside Nigeria. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The State of the Nation address by South African President Jacob Zuma was overshadowed by events before the speech, including a phone jamming controversy, a shouting match between lawmakers, and a walkout by the two largest opposition parties. VOA's Anita Powell watched the speech in Johannesburg and reports that many South Africans are saying the chaos is a true reflection of the state of this nation.
Everyone was expecting drama at this year's State of the Nation address. The ingredients were all there. President Jacob Zuma is embroiled in a corruption scandal. The nation has suffered through several weeks of regular blackouts. Numerous government departments have been accused of corruption, incompetence, lack of will, or all three. But no one could have anticipated the extent of the drama on Thursday night. Things started off badly when people realized their cell phones were blocked inside Parliament and complained to the Speaker. But the evening really went downhill with this argument between ruling ANC Speaker Baleka Mbete and the leader of the far-left economic freedom fighters, Julius Malema. Malema interrupted the proceedings to demand that Mr. Zuma pay back the $23 million in government funds that were used to upgrade his personal home.
You are actually abusing...
Which rule are you using, my Honorable Speaker?
Which rule are you using protected by the rules? You cannot be emotional about
Honorable
it. Point
Julius,
us the rule which gives you powers
Julius,
to deny us.
Honorable Malema, I now have to ask that you leave the chamber.
Mbete then summoned armed guards, who tangled with EFF members as they hustled them out of the chamber. That prompted the Speaker for the Opposition Democratic Alliance to protest the presence of police inside Parliament, then walk out in protest. When Mr. Zuma finally spoke, 1 hour later than scheduled, he delivered a lengthy monotone speech that made no mention of the night's disruptions. The next morning, presidential spokesman Mac Maharaj brushed off the night's events as nothing extraordinary.
He did say that this was one of the features of South African democracy, very robust. Partly it's a positive feature, but it's also what happened was a feature of immaturity, and that this is a matter that will have to be dealt with by Parliament. But all in all, it's nothing to become overly concerned about. It's a matter that has to be handled as work in progress in a maturing democracy.
Among the crowd on Thursday night was former President F.W. de Klerk, the nation's last apartheid president. The Nobel Peace Laureate, who was credited for helping Nelson Mandela end the racist system, was horrified by the spectacle, says the head of his foundation, Dave Stewart.
Well, it's a very sad display. It's shocking that our constitutional institutions like the Parliament should be disrupted in the unseemly manner that we observed last night.
He says he was even more surprised by Mr. Zuma's speech.
The overwhelming impression for me was a complete detachment from reality. The president was standing there giving us a list of all of the things that the government is doing to address problems and creating the impression that we're not in the midst of a crisis.
Political analyst Ebrahim Fakir of the Electoral Institute for Sustainable Democracy in Southern Africa said in the end there were winners and losers. In lightning round style, he ticked them off. The ANC lost for its clumsy response to the opposition. The EFF lost for its disruptive tactics. And the DA won for handling its grievances in an effective and calm manner. But how did the people of the Rainbow Nation fare?
They both win and lose. What we saw happening last night is not just the indiscretion of the Speaker, the undermining of the Parliament, bad behavior by political parties on both sides of the divide. This was fundamentally a reflection of the people. These people, our people.
But one thing is certain as this fractious Parliament moves on. The people will be watching. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You are listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Eighteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Cameroon is sending more troops to reinforce security at the border village of Mabas after Boko Haram militants kidnapped another 11 people. And the State of the Nation address by South African President Jacob Zuma was overshadowed by chaotic events before the speech. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. The U.S. National Institutes of Health, NIH, reports that tests of Ebola-infected macaque monkeys show that the virus in their bodies remained infectious for 7 days after their deaths. The results of the study was conducted by NIH's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. It suggests that Ebola transmission from diseased humans may be possible for an extended period of time following death. The study, published today in the Emerging Infectious Diseases Journal, underscores the importance of using safe practices for handling corpses. The published study follows claims in recent months by Ebola experts in West Africa that the family practice of washing the bodies of the dead was a major contributor to the spread of the Ebola virus. The virus has killed as many as 9,000 people in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea over the past year. More than 21,000 have been infected. An aggressive form of HIV has been discovered in Cuba. It develops into full-blown AIDS within just 3 years. Researchers say the progression happens so fast that treatment with antiretroviral drugs may come too late. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
Professor Anamika Vandama says Cuban health officials first alerted her about the aggressive form of AIDS. They asked for help in finding out what was happening.
We have a collaborative project with Cuba, and the Cuban clinicians had noticed that they recently had more and more patients who were progressing much faster to AIDS than they were used to see. In this case, most of these patients had AIDS even at diagnosis already.
Vandama is a full medical professor at the University of Leuven in Belgium. She and her team studied more than 70 patients and divided them into various groups. One group was made up of those who developed AIDS quickly.
So this group of patients that progressed very fast, they were all recently infected. And we know that because they had an HIV negative test 1 or maximum 2 years before.
She says on average, without treatment, HIV infection takes 5 to 10 years to become full-blown AIDS. That's determined by the scarcity of CD4 immune cells and the number of opportunistic infections a patient has. Usually, she says, a fast progression of HIV to AIDS is more a result of the patient's weak immune system rather than the particular subtype of HIV involved. What's happening in Cuba is different.
Here we had a variant of HIV that we found only in the group that was progressing fast, not in the other two groups. We focused then on this form and tried to find out what was different, and we saw that it was a recombinant of three different subtypes.
This new form of HIV is a combination of subtypes A, D, and G. It's been named CRF19.
Another thing was that they had much more virus in their blood than the other patients. So what we call the viral load was higher in these patients.
The patients with the aggressive form of HIV also had higher levels of a molecule called Rantes. It's released as part of the immune response and raises the alarm about infection. Researchers have determined why this form of HIV progresses to AIDS so quickly. Vandama says for infection to take place, HIV has to attach itself to a cell at what she calls anchor points. In medical terms, they're called co-receptors.
There's two types of co-receptors that HIV can use, CCR5 or CXCR4. And in the normal progression of the HIV to AIDS, it often happens that the virus switches co-receptor. It almost always starts with using CCR5, and then it switches to CXCR4 after many years. And once it switches, the progression to AIDS goes very fast.
But instead of taking many years to switch co-receptors, the new form of HIV in Cuba does it in less than 3 years. Vandama says the inclusion of HIV subtype D in the new variant may be key. It contains an enzyme that enables HIV to reproduce in greater numbers, and it takes proteins from other subtypes and uses them in new virus particles. The good news is that the aggressive form of HIV responds to most antiretroviral drugs. The bad news is people may not realize they have full-blown AIDS until it's too late for therapy to do any good. Vandama says the variant has been seen before in Africa, but there were very few such patients, and it does not appear to be spreading there. However, it is in wide circulation now in Cuba and can be easily studied. So, there may be an African link, but further study is needed. She says it's vital for people having unprotected sex with multiple partners to be tested for HIV early and often. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The Egyptian government today released two Egyptian journalists following yesterday's court order in Cairo. Mohamed Fahmy and Bahar Mohamed are two of three Al Jazeera journalists held for a year on charges of supporting the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood. The charges were made following their reporting on street demonstrations in Cairo for the International Media Agency. Their arrest drew international criticism that Egypt was violating freedom of the press. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon welcomed their release, but the reporters likely face a retrial on the charges. Mohamed Fahmy gave up his Egyptian citizenship recently in an apparent effort to move to Canada, where he also holds a citizenship. Bahar Mohamed holds only Egyptian citizenship. A third defendant, Australian Peter Gresty, was released after paying bail of $33,000. Gresty has returned to Australia, where he told a news agency that their trial continues and nobody has yet been acquitted. Many shark species are endangered or threatened, the result of fishing, climate change, and ocean pollution. Scientists are getting a shark-eye view of their environment to better understand the threats this important predators face. Michael Sullivan reports from Honolulu.
The University of Hawaii research site on Coconut Island is just minutes by motorboat from the shore of Oahu, the most populated island in the Hawaiian chain. The facility is a good place to observe sharks since they are native to local waters, and some are kept in this sheltered bay for study. Carl Meyer does research on sharks and tries to learn about their habits.
When sharks are feeding and hopefully how much they're eating, and that's what we use these captive animals for.
Scientists also monitor the behavior of sharks at sea, placing sensing pellets in their food to monitor digestion, measuring the animals, and then releasing them with radio-equipped electronic tags attached to their fins. The researchers study tiger sharks, sandbar sharks, blacktip sharks, and others, and they recently fitted a sandbar shark with a camera for a rare shark's eye view of its daily activities.
When we recovered the camera, we saw that the shark had spent the day in a large aggregation of sharks, not just sandbar sharks, but also blacktip sharks and many, many scalloped hammerhead sharks.
Sharks are swift and lethal, but don't usually prey on humans. Meyer says that rare attacks are amplified by the media and dramatized in films, like the 1975 thriller Jaws. He says sharks are important top-level predators that help maintain the balance of the marine systems. Those systems are threatened by pollution, climate change, and commercial fishing, as fishermen target sharks for the Asian food market and kill them in the process of harvesting other species. University of Hawaii scientists are studying endangered and vulnerable shark populations, and Carl Meyer says that humans are more of a risk to sharks than sharks to humans.
Because never before in the natural history of the world have we seen a species become so dominant and so able to alter the natural environment.
And he says the results of those environmental changes cannot always be predicted. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Coconut Island, Hawaii.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Celebrate the
the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Cameroon is sending more troops to reinforce security at the border village of Mabas after Boko Haram militants kidnapped another 11 people. And the State of the Nation address by South African President Jacob Zuma was overshadowed by chaotic events before the speech. Coming up, music from Uganda. And in our feature segment, recognizing the history and achievement of African Americans on this Black History Month. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the Sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Friday, Yehiz.
I understand that you're beginning your sports report with the basketball.
Yehiz, let's tip off in New York City, where the National Basketball Association will celebrate its best players Sunday night. The 64th annual NBA All-Star Game will be played at Madison Square Garden. Several players originally selected for the exhibition contest will not participate because of injury. They are Kobe Bryant of the Los Angeles Lakers, Blake Griffin of the Los Angeles Clippers, Dwayne Wade of the Miami Heat, and power forward center Anthony Davis of the New Orleans Pelicans. The 21-year-old Davis is one of the NBA's big rising stars. He finished third in fan balloting for the All-Star Game and was scheduled to start for the Western Conference. But Davis decided not to play in the popular game because of a shoulder injury.
I am disappointed. You know, it's my first time being selected as a starter to play in the game. But, you know, I'm looking at the bigger picture. Shoulder wasn't ready two games ago. Not sure it's going to be ready by All-Star, by the game Sunday. I'm not sure, you know. But, you know, I don't want to risk it, especially when my team has a great chance of being in the playoffs. So, start with the trainers, coaches, GM, and just try to figure it all out and, you know, give somebody else a chance to go out there and play, you know, and I don't want to, you know, be a disservice to the team where I can't do anything, you know, anything, but I'm still here, you know, to support them 100% right there with them on the bench cheering them on.
As we look forward to the NBA All-Star Game, let's cheer on the Gasol brothers, Marc Gasol of the Memphis Grizzlies and his older brother, Pau Gasol of the Chicago Bulls. It marks the first time in NBA history two brothers have been picked to start in an All-Star game. And who knows, another guy cheering them on in New York could be Jay-Z.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm out at Brooklyn. Now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to the Narrow. But I'll be hood forever. I'm the new Sinatra. And since I made it here, I can make it anywhere. Yeah, they love me everywhere. I used to cop in Harlem. All of my Dominicanos right there up on Broadway. Pulled me back to that McDonald's. Took it to my stash spot, 560 State Street. Catch me in the kitchen like a Simmons whipping pastry. Cruising down A Street, off-white Lexus. Driving so slow, but BK is from Texas. Me, I'm out that Bed-Stuy, home of that boy Biggie. Now I live on Billboard and I brought my boys with me. Say what up to Tata, still sipping my ties, sitting courtside, Knicks and Nets give me high five. I be spiked out, I could trip a referee, tell by my attitude that I most definitely from
I'm
Lightning Bolt. I'm not flash guarding anybody. My name is Lightning Bolt.
The Lightning Bolt, Usain Bolt, was also in New York this week, and the Jamaican star received a warm welcome in the city's iconic Times Square.
Let's welcome the world's fastest man, Usain Bolt!
What's up, Times Square?
The world's fastest man was in New York for a promotional appearance. New York is where the Lightning Bolt first broke the world record for 100 meters in 2008.
It's always just great to be back here in New York. First time I broke my world record in front of many people, in front of a lot of Jamaicans also. So for me, I know there's a lot of Jamaicans here. So it's always just a special place to come back to our family here and everything. So it's always just wonderful.
It's also been just wonderful when you talk about Usain Bolt's career in athletics. He's the first man to win 6 Olympic gold medals in sprinting. Bolt's first 3 Olympic gold medals came in 2008 in Beijing, and he's looking forward to returning to the Chinese capital in August for the World Championships.
Yeah, I'm really pumped and excited because that's where it all began. And for me, it's just a great feeling to go back there and to do my best and to just to even do better than I did the last time. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Usain Bolt, looking forward to the 2015 World Championships in Athletics, which will be held from August 22nd to August 30th in Beijing, China. In addition to his 6 Olympic gold medals, Usain Bolt is an 8-time world champion. Just ahead on the sunny side of sports, the VOA's Tef Tef and Downtown Brown will have our English Premier League football question of the week.
Welcome back. It's VOA's Downtown Brown.
And I'm Tef Tef.
So the question of the week was, UEFA Champions League is kicking off February 17th. There are 3 EPL teams that will be tested by France and Spain. Chelsea will go against PSG, Arsenal will go against Monaco, and Manchester City will go against Barcelona. And do you see Chelsea, Arsenal, and Man City making it to the quarterfinals? So, Tef, let's see what you got for your question of the week.
So there were a few good answers, and the one I went with today is actually Ondoma Emmanuel from Jos, Nigeria. And his answer was, it is a knockout, King Sun Young. Thus, I believe all 3 have a good chance. Experience has shown that Chelsea and Arsenal are more experienced at this stage. That certainly will have a telling effect on their chances. So, I like this answer because I think he really underlined the main challenge for Manchester City, its experience. This is their first time out of the group stages. They've tried multiple times, and this is the first time they've gone through. And their luck has it, they're playing one of the best teams in Europe. And what about yours? What did you have?
A team, Marcus, from Nigeria, who said, it actually gave us percentages.
Chelsea, very scientific. Fine scientific.
Yeah, very, very scientific. Chelsea 70%, Arsenal 60%, and Man City 30%. And this is perfectly exactly how I want to see it, because Arsenal, you never know what they can do. You know, Arsenal has been losing to a couple of bad teams, and they've been beating amazing good teams too at the same time. So Chelsea going against PSG, it's gonna be a tough matchup.
Sure, and they should be back. I mean, Costa at least is gonna be back from his ban very soon.
Yep.
And Hazard actually with the big booster by signing a new 5.5-year contract, so that's like a huge mind game for for Chelsea. And so they've been trying to get to tie this guy down. He might not stay, but at least it says that I'm here for a while. Outside of that, I'm going to go with the experience factor again. Chelsea and Arsenal have seen this. So at the very least, I think Arsenal will get some sort of win at home and then maybe another draw outside, away, and then go through. Chelsea, it's a rematch of last year, but they've strengthened since then. Last year, Ibrahimovic didn't play in the first game, but he came back in the second one and was kind of, you know.
But at the same time, you also got to remember David Luiz is on PSG now.
Sure, sure. I mean, and that's the thing. I don't know if he's going to be a huge of a factor. I think he had his best days at Chelsea. Yeah. And so, I mean, Chelsea, they've strengthened in the back. Sometimes it can be shaky with Cahill and Co. But if they have Ivanovic, Terry. If Ivanovic doesn't get banned after yesterday's game, They actually have a better chance, I think. But outside of that, City, tough luck. So another thing that Chelsea has going for them is the fact that they're actually out of the FA Cup. So they're not playing this weekend.
Yeah.
And so playing PSG very soon, they're going to, you know, they're going to be well rested.
Yeah. So, because rather than Man City and Arsenal, they have game, and also in the Barclays Premier League too.
Exactly.
They have games in there too. So and the deciding factor you also got to put in, does Arsenal want to win the FA Cup or do they want to move towards the UEFA Champions League?
Sure. And the title, I mean, yeah, the title is kind of in Chelsea's hands. That's probably a negative factor for all three, by the way. We have to say that they're all like in the top four contention. So that's tough. Sometimes it's easier when you have no chance of, you know, being top four so you can focus on the trophies.
So injuries this week, we have Alex Sanchez with the knee injury and Ramsey with muscle injury, and there's no return date so far. And for Chelsea and Man City, there are absolutely zero major injuries. That's it for today.
And thank you for listening, guys.
I'm VOA's Downtown Brown.
And I'm Tef Tef.
Turning to African football, Equatorial Guinea, which hosted and reached the semifinals at the recent Nations Cup tournament, is the biggest mover in the February FIFA World Rankings. The National Thunder of Equatorial Guinea stormed up 69 places to 49th overall, which puts Equatorial Guinea even with Congo Brazzaville at number 11 in Africa. Taking a quick look at the top 10 African teams, according to FIFA, Algeria remains number one on the continent and is 18th overall. Newly crowned African champion Ivory Coast is 20th overall, followed by Nations Cup finalist Ghana at 25 and Tunisia at 26. The Cape Verde Islands is 35th overall and Senegal is at number 36. Rounding out the top 10 African teams, we have Nigeria at 42, Guinea at 43, Cameroon at 45, and the Democratic Republic of Congo at 46. Taking a look at the very top of the FIFA rankings, World Cup champion Germany remains number one overall, followed by Argentina, Colombia, Belgium, and the Netherlands. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny, and my Twitter handle is at @VOASunnySports. Tweet, tweet, tweet. I'm VOA Sunny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Yeheus Wuhi.
Thank you, Sunny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, recognizing the history and achievements of African Americans on the Black History Month. And next, reaching out to South Sudan with a message of hope and peace. But first, some music. Here is George Okudi of Uganda with Africa Survival.
Bafana Nelson Mandela. Watch out the money. Little children suffering by cooking post Africa. Everybody's fighting for survival in the street.
Africa, I'm coming through my Nebadilika.
People and the children are the needy folk today.
George Okudi of Uganda with Africa Survival. Team building and good management are essential to business success, according to studies from journals of sociology or industrial psychology. But Clifton Tolbert is an African-American businessman who says common sense works, the kind he discovered during segregation over 50 years ago. In part two of our two-part interview, reporter William Eagle asked Tolbert about some of the values he grew up with that can be used to improve business management.
Nurturing attitude, responsibility, dependability, friendship, brotherhood, sisterhood, high expectations, courage, and hope. All of these eight habits were people in my community, and they lived out these habits in my presence, on my behalf, and for my future. I've come to understand that those eight habits are timeless and universal.
Now, how do you incorporate those habits into your workshops? When you're teaching and giving conferences and seminars to such varied groups as NATO and to companies like Lockheed Martin, Bank of America.
You know, when I have the opportunity to work with corporate America or to work across the board with companies from around the world or with political parties around the world, the one thing that we all understand is that culture matters. Our actions are shaped by the culture that surrounds us. And whether it's Lockheed Martin or whether it's the opportunity I had in Brussels, Belgium, speaking to a gathering of NATO employees, they all understand that if the culture is not good, it literally just takes away from performance, and it takes away from being your very best. Not only do you not maximize your potential, but in some regard, you diminish the outcomes of the bottom line, however that is defined. So I begin, as I go into my workshops, let's look at the culture, and let's look at leaders embracing the types of principles that will not only build, but sustain the culture. And that's when we look at nurturing attitude. Nurturing attitude is how do we use our time? And this is what I will ask the CEO of a company, a president, or a supervisor. You have to look at this habit of the heart as an asset to bring into your culture. You have to start with the premise that everybody matters, and you want to allocate time to support that. And then you begin to look at responsibility. And I want them to understand that responsibility is not just something in the dictionary, a term, but responsibility is the person that in the world of work, people look up, and what they tend to see gives the signal as to what is expected of them. So responsibility is the unselfish sharing of knowledge so that responsibility can emerge from that. So again, we're talking about inclusivity. We're talking about collaboration. All of those things comes about as responsibility moves into the workplace, and then there's dependability. You know, people give their words, but are they keeping their word? When I grew up in the Mississippi Delta, when someone gave me their word that I mattered, they kept that. And because they kept their word, my life was transformed. And I bring that into the workplace, supervisors, managers, employees. We have customers. that we serve. When we give our word, we have to keep that word. We have to become dependability, and our actions, if you will, within the culture of our workplace defines the outcome that we will expect. And it goes through all eight habits to courage, standing up and doing what's right. The easiest thing to do sometimes is to close our eyes and move on. But then a problem comes up because no one took the courage or the time to stand up, call something out, bring it to the attention of whomever to make sure that this was dealt with right then and there. So you can't have a good, collaborative, inclusive work environment without men and women being literally brought to bear that courage is absolutely essential. Then, of course, there's high expectation. Why hire a person if you're not expecting that person to do his or her best? And if you're not willing to provide them the tools that would allow them to be their best? And even more importantly, when someone does well, don't just accept this as the norm, but make this something to celebrate and to showcase so that others understand that their good efforts are well noted, well appreciated, and a real part of the success of the organization.
So it's a very open team. It's a very collaborative team where employees are encouraged to speak up and to contribute and also to question things if they seem to be going awry.
Most definitely. Every person needs to really understand the vision, needs to really understand the mission. And when those two are embraced, it becomes much easier to understand your place in that mission and within that vision. And then it becomes even easier to understand that there is no place for narcissism in a very successful environment. That's why building community, as I call it, becomes the job and the opportunity of every employee on a daily and continuous basis.
That was author and businessman Clifton Tolbert speaking with reporter William Eagle. About a dozen students at a small American college are reaching out to their counterparts in South Sudan with a message of hope and peace. For their class assignment, the students created public service announcement called Developing Media for Social Change. Reporter Carol Van Dam talked to some of the students and has this report.
13 students are taking the class at Colby College in the northeastern state of Maine. Most of them, like Thomas Cleary, say they always look forward to this class, particularly the project on South Sudan.
It's really different from a lot of the other education classes in that we're talking about social change, we're talking about creating a difference in the world.
Every person in South Sudan is part of a family. They are a brother, a sister, a mother, a father. Every victim of violence is someone's son or daughter. Take the stand today against the violence that tears families apart.
Thomas and his team focus their message for South Sudan on rejecting violence.
We really just want people to think about the choices they make as far as violence goes and the repercussions that violence has and how they can change that.
Thomas says in his research, he learned about the thousands of people who were killed in South Sudan's ongoing violence, about the millions of displaced people, and about South Sudan's child soldiers.
What we as a group discovered is that there's no way that we could really relate to that because it's on such a different level from anything that we've ever experienced.
Pass me the ball sometimes, man. I'm open every time.
I would if you could shoot.
You!
Why is violence always the choice?
Darian Pipkin's team used the setting of a basketball game to get their point across.
And we wanted them to argue and then fight and then go into a soothing voice with music to, like, calm the situation down and explain why we shouldn't fight.
So why basketball?
Youth all around the world comes together and play sports. And sports is something that everybody understands, and there's some sport that brings us all together. And we felt that basketball was a connection between the two.
If I meet someone who is different from me, I choose to learn from them.
This PSA notes that while there are vast differences in the American and South Sudanese cultures, every person makes choices about their future.
Every choice matters. What will yours be?
Lauren Gluck, an education minor at Colby College, admits she did not know much about South Sudan when she started the project.
I didn't know there was a civil war going on before. Now I know that
these kids are being pulled into fighting. I didn't know that. I didn't know that the situation with the different tribes was going on. I didn't know that they hated each other so much, that there was so much violence and killing, and that the kids especially were seeing so much of it.
Power comes in many forms. Violence is not the only way to show it.
Define power for yourself. 6,500 miles away, we support you.
Sarah Peck, an education major, was the team leader for her PSA.
So we talk about power and the different forms of power.
Peck says her team's PSA was all about showing young people in South Sudan that although they may feel pressured to join one side or another in the conflict, they can show they have power without resorting to violence. She says social media has helped her and the other students at Colby College get their messages across.
I'm really interested in social media and how that works in terms of kind of affecting change and how big of a role that plays in kids' lives now.
Darian Pipkin agrees social media is a major tool for young people who want to be seen and heard. He says his team had one clear message for their counterparts in South Sudan.
We are friends, family, neighbors. We shouldn't be fighting one another, because together, if we work together and do everything we need to, that we can become stronger.
The students at Colby College say they plan to continue to follow events in South Sudan, and they hope that one day soon, the South Sudanese people will be able to live in peace. Carol Van Dam for VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Following a long delay caused by political infighting, the Somali parliament has overwhelmingly approved Prime Minister Omar Abdulrashid Ali Shamarke's selections to head cabinet ministries. The 191-22 vote sets the stage for lawmakers to ratify the Constitution and pass a variety of urgently needed laws to prepare for presidential elections in 2016. The country's parliament was at an impasse since October, when differences between President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud and then Prime Minister Abdulwali Sheikh Ahmed reached a pinnacle. The dispute led to Ahmed's dismissal and the eventual appointment of Shamarke. Since then, the new prime minister has faced an uphill task in convincing lawmakers that his cabinet choices will help end Somalia's long-running political crisis. With approval of his cabinet selections, the prime minister said his government will improve security, justice, health, national reconciliation, and the country's infrastructure. The United States welcomes the February 9th parliamentary confirmation of Somalia's Council of Ministers. As the new cabinet assumes office, we urge the federal government of Somalia to make swift progress in the important work that remains to realize its vision 2016, including a constitutional referendum and national elections. Somalia's progress toward realizing its peace-building, governance, and security goals is of critical importance to the people of Somalia and the broader region. The United States is committed to supporting the government and people of Somalia. We look forward to strengthening our partnership with the Somali government and people as they work to stabilize and rebuild their country.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here.